Okay, so this talk is called Face to Face with Reality. And those of you who are nearly as old as I am, you might remember a radio program that went out on Radio 4 called Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And some of you who are a lot younger might have heard of it as well, because it's been around several times. And as you can guess, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was a comic science fiction series. And one of the characters was this really annoying galactic president called Zaphod Beeblebrox, who was less like a politician than a sort of spoiled rock star. He was sort of hip, as we used to say then, cool, and completely full of himself, despite being really rather stupid, well, appearances. And, you know, he just was totally concerned with himself. He had this line, which I can't remember what occurred: "If there's an ego bigger than mine round here, I want to hear about it." Zaphod Beeblebrox was a sort of symbol or an archetype of ego. Not ego as the psychologists use the term, but ego as it's popularly used, the part of us that thinks we're just so special, so important, that thinks in terms of me, me, me. This is the part of our mind that pricks its ears up when we hear our name mentioned, that always looks, if there are some pictures of an event, always looks to see if our picture is there. We've all got our inner Zaphod Beeblebrox. And as well as characters like Zaphod Beeblebrox, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy also was full of these really quirky, inventive ideas for gadgets and machines and things like that. And one of these quirky ideas was a thing called the Total Perspective Vortex. If you were put into the Total Perspective Vortex, your perspective suddenly opened up so that you weren't just seeing the little world we usually focus on. You were seeing the whole of reality and your place in it. So you would see the billions of human beings on this tiny little speck of a planet. And you would see that tiny little speck going around this tiny little speck of a sun. And you'd see that as one sun among billions of suns. And you would see that planet just existing for a tiny short flash amidst the immense tracts of time. And in the midst of this mind-boggling immensity of time and space, you would see a little tiny sign, a little tiny arrow pointed to an imperceptible speck. And if you look really closely, you could see it said, "You are here." And in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the Total Perspective Vortex was used as a punishment for major crimes. Being put into the Total Perspective Vortex was a completely crushing experience. It was said that everybody who had ever experienced the Total Perspective Vortex had gone completely mad, except for one. So the one exception was Zaphod Beeblebrox, because his ego was so huge that he was completely immune. So he had seen all that. He'd seen that that huge perspective of time and space and his imperceptibly small time place in it, and he still thought that he was the most important thing in the universe. So being put into the Total Perspective Vortex was an encounter with reality. And for everybody except Zaphod Beeblebrox, an encounter with reality was a devastating experience, a shattering experience. It was shattering because we unenlightened beings, we don't actually live in reality. Our model of the world is not reality. We live in our ego's extremely deluded, but much more flattering and comfortable and cozy version of things. An imaginary world in which me is special. Special and uniquely important, not one speck among billions of others on a tiny speck of rock orbiting a sun among billions of suns, not just a fleeting thing that lives for a moment amid vast tracts of time, but really important and really special. And if we live in that sort of cozy delusion, then coming to face to face with reality is not going to be a cozy experience. coming face to face with the Buddha, who is reality in human form, is not going to be a cozy experience. Okay, well, this retreat, this weekend, is about encounters with the Buddha. So we're telling stories of real people who came face to face with the historical Buddha. People who encountered reality in human form. And the effect this had on them. Coming face to face with the Buddha would have meant coming face to face with reality. If we dared, if we got near enough and we allowed ourselves, and he allowed us, and we looked deeply into his eyes, we might have been found ourselves looking into the total perspective vortex. The perspective of reality. Okay, at this point I should stress that everything we read about the Buddha and everything we hear about the Buddha, from that we know that he was always concerned above all with the well-being of the people he met and the people he talked to. Okay, that's what he thought about. He thought about their well-being. And generally, it was probably not conducive to the well-being of the people he was meeting to put them into the total perspective vortex. Okay, to drive them mad. In the words of the poet T.S. Eliot, humankind cannot bear very much reality. So the Buddha tended to give reality in homeopathic doses. He let people see reality in small doses, the doses that we could cope with and benefit from. So most of the people we read about in the Pali Canon were not shattered by the experience of meeting the Buddha. They might have had their limiting views challenged, but the Buddha was usually very, very kind and polite and gentle with folk. But it wasn't always like that. The encounter with the Buddha that I'm going to talk about today was a bit different. In this encounter, the person meeting the Buddha almost was shattered. I'm sure at the time he felt shattered. Okay. Even if we can see that he benefited from it, in the end. But what benefits us spiritually is not always what we want or what seems pleasant at the time. So today I'm going to talk about how a young man called Ambata came face to face with the Buddha and how he found that to be not at all a comfortable or an easy experience. In fact, he found it an awesome, even a scary experience, even a terrifying experience. So I'll be talking about that experience, but I'll also be asking, why was Ambata's encounter with the Buddha such a difficult experience? Why was it such a crushing experience? What might we all have in common with Ambata? And leading on from that, what do we need to do to make ourselves ready to come face to face with the Buddha without that being such a shattering experience? With that being a positive experience rather than a shattering one. So those are the three questions I'm going to sort of try and draw out from this story. So, okay, the story starts 2,500 years ago with the Buddha and a number of his followers in northern India arriving at a Brahmin village, in the kingdom of Kosala called Ikanankala. So he arrives there and he decides to spend time in the forest near that village. He decides that he'll set up his sangha in the forest near that village. Now, on a rich estate on the outskirts of that village in Kanankala, there lived a rich and powerful and famous Brahmin teacher called Pokarasadi. And this Pokarasadi, he'd heard about the Buddha. And he'd heard that he was staying nearby and he'd heard really favourable reports about him. So in the sutta, he says to himself, people are saying that this Gotama is a fully awakened one, abounding in wisdom and goodness, happy, unsurpassed as a guide of those who are willing to be taught, a Buddha. They say that he thoroughly knows and sees this universe face to face. And having known it, he makes his knowledge known to others. He teaches the beautiful truth. He makes known the higher life in all its beauty. It would be a good thing to visit him. But Pogrosai doesn't actually visit the Buddha himself. I mean, maybe it would have been too much to risk for such an exalted personage to go and see this penniless wanderer, especially if he didn't know whether he was genuine or not. So what he does, instead, he asks one of his chief disciples to go instead and check the Buddha out. So he says to this young man, Ambata, "Now then, dear Ambata, go to this wanderer, Gotama, and find out whether his reputation is true or not." So Ambata sets out to do what his teacher has asked him. He sets out to go to the Buddha, but he doesn't just sort of put on his sandals and stroll along. He goes in style. He goes in style. He gathers a retinue of young Brahmins on horseback. I can imagine them all being very richly dressed. He gathers this retinue of young Brahmins on horseback, and he himself mounts a grand horsed chariot to go off and see the Buddha. And I think this tells us a lot about Ambata. For a start, he is a high social status leader. If he goes somewhere, he can gather a retinue of other young men to go with him as his attendants, a bit like a petty king travelling with his court. And that's part of his identity. That's part of his identity, to be a high status social leader. It's part of his self-image. So if he's going to see the Buddha, he takes his identity with him. He takes his self-image with him, his retinue. And the second thing is that while the other young men go on horseback, which already puts them above the level of the common pedestrian, like the Buddha, while the other young men go on horseback, he goes on a grand chariot. So he places himself even above the young men he's going with, on this grand chariot. He makes himself special by placing himself on a grand chariot. And again, he takes that identity with him when he goes to see the Buddha. I am special. I'm really someone. I'm really special. But as we've heard, the Buddha was staying in the forest. And chariots don't work very well in forests. There tend to be sort of trees in the way and undergrowth and things like that. They're not even particularly good for horses. So, and the paths are narrow and, you know, it just doesn't work. So as soon as, it isn't very long at all into his journey when Ambata has to get down off his chariot and walk. And the young men have to send their horses back. And there's something very symbolic, I think, about Ambata having to get down off his chariot to approach the Buddha. So this sort of thing happens a lot in the Pali Canon. It happens a lot. When someone thinks they're very special and shows this by travelling in grand style to meet the Buddha, then when they get anywhere near the Buddha, they always have to get off and walk. When a king goes to see the Buddha in procession, with his ministers and his courtiers and his concubines all seated on grandly decorated huge elephants, surrounded by armed men and acrobats and tumblers and people holding banners and people holding umbrellas. As soon as he gets anywhere near the Buddha, he's forced to get down off his elephant, send most of his attendants home, and walk on his own 2 feet like the ordinary human being that he is. Ambata's chariot and the king's procession of elephants symbolizes the fact that the person who is approaching the Buddha thinks they're really special. So special that in their heart of hearts they secretly put themselves above the Buddha that they're going to see. So Ambata has to get down off his chariot, get down off the chariot that makes him so special. That's a symbol of his specialness, and he has to walk like everybody else. And he doesn't like it. He doesn't like it. So when Ambata and his followers are eventually shown into the makeshift hut where the Buddha is staying, we're told The other young Brahmins exchanged polite and courteous greetings with the Buddha and took their seats. But Ambata greeted the Buddha in an offhand way and stayed standing up, flicking his fingers and walking about and fidgeting while the Buddha stayed seated. And the Buddha's a bit, this guy's sort of doing all these funny things, and the Buddha says, "Is that the way, Ambata, that you hold discussion with aged teachers and the teachers of your teachers who are well advanced in years?" And Ambata replies, "Certainly not, Gotama. It's proper to speak with a Brahmin standing if he is standing, or seated if he is seated, or reclining if he is reclining. But with shaveling beggars, phony holy men, and menial blackfellows who are like dirt on the feet of my noble family, to them I talk as I now do to you." Well, that'd be hugely insulting to most people. I mean, that is a real, he's just really had a go at the Buddha, really insulting. But the Buddha is above being insulted. He's above it. And he just stays unfailingly polite. He says, "But you must have been wanting something, Ambata, when you came here. Remember why you came here, or I will think of you, this young Brahmin is ill-bred, although he prides himself on his culture." Then the sutta tells us that Ambata was displeased and angry at being called rude, although he was obviously being rude, and he spoke to the Buddha in a scoffing, jeering way, saying, "You Shakyans are a rough bunch. Gotama, rude and touchy and violent. You are a clan of low-life menials who do not honour your betters." And still the Buddha stays polite. And he says, "Have the Shakyans offended you in some way, Ambata?" And Ambata replies, "Once, Gotama, I had to go to Kapilavastu on some business and I went into the Shakyans' meeting hall. And there were a number of Shakyans, old and young, seated in the hall on grand seats, making merry and laughing and joking together, and I think it was at me that they were laughing. Not one of them even offered me a seat." So, I mean, given Ambata's attitude, I think we can just imagine the scene. It is actually possible that he goes into the Shakyans' meeting hall feeling and acting oh so special, and the Shakyans find this stuck-up young man hilarious and do laugh and joke at his expense. That is possible. But much more likely is that Ambata just imagined that. Here were people who just happened to be laughing and joking and were not paying him any attention, but Ambata thinks he is the centre of the universe. So everything that happens around him must have some reference to him. So they must have been laughing and joking at him. And just to add insult to injury, they are seated on what he sees as grand seats. And he's not. So they are making themselves more special than him. So he doesn't like it. Anyway, so that's his reason, apparently, for disliking the Shakyans. Anyway, by this time, the Buddha has got Ambata's number. And the sutta tells us that the Buddha thought, "This Ambata is very set on humbling others. It would do him a favour if I were to humble him." Scary. "It would do him a favour if I were to humble him." Ambata has got off his chariot in a physical sense because he had to, but in his mind he's still firmly on his grand chariot. He's above everybody else, above the Buddha. And he is going to carry on being laughably stupid, a fool, until he gets down and puts himself on a proper level. So the Buddha thinks, "It would do him a favour if I were to humble him." The Buddha is doing him a favour, but it's not a favour that he's likely to welcome. As I've said, the Buddha is usually unfailingly polite and considerate, but he is also a formidable person. Well, not even a person, he is a formidable force. you mess with him at your peril, as Ambata is about to find out. So he starts off by asking Ambata a simple question. Ambata, what is the name of your family? And Ambata replies proudly, I am a Kanhayana. And already the Buddha's got him. Already he's seen the way that Ambata's sense of his own specialness is a lie, as our sense of our own specialness always is a lie. So the Buddha says, in which case, if one were to follow up your ancient name and lineage, Ambata, it would appear that the Shakyans were once your masters, and that you are the offspring of one of their servant girls. So the Buddha says, isn't that true, Ambata? Isn't that the origin of your family? And Ambata just sits there and refuses to answer. We can probably imagine the expression on his face as he sits there and he refuses to answer. So the Buddha asks the question a second time. Isn't it true, Ambata? Isn't it true that your family were once servants among the Shakyans and that one of your ancestors was a Shakyan slave girl? And again, Ambata sits silent and refuses to answer. So the Buddha asks the question a third time. Isn't it true, Ambata? Isn't it true that your ancestors were once servants of the Shakyans and that one of them was a Shakyan slave girl? And again, Ambata refuses to answer. And at this point in the story, something surprising and shocking happens. The Buddha says, I warn you, Ambata, if you do not answer, if you try to change the subject, or if you leave without answering me, your head will be split into pieces. Is what I said true, or is it not? And suddenly Ambata sees the terrifying figure of Vajrapani, towering over him with a huge iron Vajra club in his hand, surrounded by flames, fiery, dazzling, full of energy and determination, ready to split Ambata's head into pieces with his club. Only the Buddha and Ambata can see this terrible, fearsome, fiery figure standing over Ambata. And Ambata is terrified, and he cowers down by the Buddha's side in awe, clutching at the Buddha's robe and begging the Buddha to protect him. So some of us will be very familiar with the figure of Vajrapani or Vajrapani. But if you've never come across him, you might be asking yourself, what on earth is going on here? What is going on here? Just very briefly, I'd say that Vajrapani or Vajrapani is a figure who crops up several times in the Pali canon as a sort of protector or guardian of the Buddha. So the myth goes that he started out as what is called a yaksha in Sanskrit, what Padmavajra mentioned yesterday, as a yaka, a sort of nature spirit, a nature spirit bristling with fierce warrior energy, even demonic energy. So that's how Vajrapani started out. He's this sort of natural force of nature. But he was converted. He heard the Buddha teach the Dharma, and he was converted to the Dharma. So he appointed himself as the Buddha's protector and guardian. You might have seen something like this at school. There might have been a sort of really clever kid who was a bit small, and some big lad, so I'll look after him. It's a bit like that. Vajrapani is elected himself as the Buddha's protector and guardian. And in later Buddhism, he becomes a major figure in his own right, who represents the awesome strength and energy and fearsome power of the enlightened mind, at least in his wrathful form. But he also has a peaceful form we've got up there. So he becomes, in one way, and certainly in one of his forms, a very strong and fierce, a symbol of the strong and fearsome aspect of the enlightened mind. We could say that what Vajrapani really represents in his mythic way is the awesome aspect of the Buddha. the aspect of the reality that seems terrifying to us as long as we are still metaphorically trying to pretend we are up on our chariot, as long as we're still trying to be special, above other people, above the Buddha. Vajrapani is what reality looks like if you look into the total perspective vortex while you're still on your chariot. So that's what the sutta tells us happened. The Buddha says, you better answer me now, Ambata, or your head will split into pieces. Is it or is it not the case that your ancestor was a servant girl of the Shakyans? And Ambata sees this enormous, terrifying figure of Vajrapani towering over him, surrounded by crackling flames, quivering with energy, with a huge iron club in his hand. And Ambata is terrified, cowers down by the Buddha's side in awe, clutching the Buddha's robe and begging the Buddha to protect him. And as he does this, he cries out in fear, it is just as the venerable Gotama said, that is the origin of the Katayanas. And then the sutta tells us that all the young Brahmins who had come with Ambata, who couldn't see Vajrapani, towering over them all, they all fell about laughing, saying, Ambata, who is so high and mighty, is descended from a slave girl. And his family is so proud of, were once the servants of the Shakyans. And then the Buddha turns to them and rebukes them, saying, do not disparage Ambata on the grounds of his descent. Kanya, who founded his family, became a mighty seer. And in the supreme perfection of wisdom, there is no reference to birth or lineage, and no place for the pride of status. Whoever is in bondage to the pride of status, they are far from wisdom. It is only by having got rid of all such bondage that one can realize the supreme perfection of wisdom. So that's the story of what happened when Ambata came face to face with the Buddha. So I'd like to unpack the meaning of that a little bit and just look at the questions that I raised earlier. So why was Ambata's encounter with the Buddha so much more difficult than most people's? What might we have in common with Ambata? And that being the case, what do we need to do to make ourselves ready to come face to face with the Buddha, to come face to face with reality without that being a shattering experience? So Ambata has such a hard time when he comes face to face with the Buddha because he didn't really leave his chariot behind when he got off it in the woods. When he approached the Buddha, he was still trying to be special, above others, above even the Buddha. So he had constructed an image of himself that made him special, this social leader. And this image of himself as special was based on a lie. Based on ignoring the reality of who he truly was. It was all based on this, his self-image was based on the social status of his family. And he was ignoring certain facts about that. He was hiding them from others and from himself, although he knew them. So what have we got in common? I mean, like Ambata, we all have an image of ourselves that we present to the world, and that we believe in to some extent ourselves. We've all got our chariot. Or changing our metaphor, we all tend to build this very rickety pedestal of self-image for ourselves to stand on, a very fragile, unreliable pedestal that won't stand too much rocking and shaking. It's a pedestal that allows us to feel special and in some ways superior. So for us, I mean, it's very unlikely that we build our pedestal based on family status. That's very, very unlikely. But we might base it on something else. I mean, so we might be based, for example, on our intelligence or our success in some worldly field of activity. I have to say that it was very much for me. I used to sort of build myself a sort of status around that. When I first came to the Dharma, I was sort of successful academically and reasonably successful in worldly professional way. And because of that, I felt quite justified in thinking that I often knew better than the Dharma. There were bits of the Dharma that I could accept, but, there were bits that You know, I was too clever to accept. You know, I mean, it was all right for them, but I could see that. You know, so I was, you know, I was too clever for the Dharma. I put myself above the Dharma, and I could also ignore the inconvenient challenges and demands of the Sangha, because I was such a clever, successful chap that I knew best and could do it on my own. I put myself on a pedestal above the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. I mean, so when we come across the Dharma, we don't meet the Buddha face to face. And if we put ourselves above the Buddha, that's manifested by us putting ourselves above the Dharma, above the Sangha, which are sort of manifestations of the Buddha. So I put myself on a pedestal above the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha based on my worldly success and my supposedly brilliant intelligence. Although all that cleverness and all that success had not created a happy life for me. So like Ambarta's pride in his family, my pedestal was not based on reality. It was based on a very selective sort of dose of reality. And that was my way of doing it at the time. But in our different ways and all the time, we all build a pedestal that makes us special. Bits of the pedestal might include, I mean, silly things. It might include the type of music we listen to that makes us superior to people who listen to a different sort of music. Or the books we read, or the films we like, or the newspapers we read, or the sort of clothes we wear, or the sort of people we hang out with, or our particular sort of collection of opinions. We're not likely to pride ourselves on being upper class, like Ambarta, but part of our pedestal might actually be now that we're working class. So being working class might be something that makes us special. Or our sexual inclinations might make us special. Or even negative things might make us special. Our unique victimhood or our unique suffering. Even our weaknesses might make us special. Or our psychological complexity might make us special. But before we can come face to face with the Buddha, before we can come face to face with reality, if we don't want that to be a shattering experience, we need to get down off our rickety pedestal before it's pushed over. We need to leave our chariot behind before we can even get a glimpse of reality, a glimpse of insight. Okay, so how do we do that? How do we do that? How do we practice the Dharma in a way that helps us to get down off our chariot? And get down off our pedestal before it's pushed over. Well, I'm pretty sure the secret to that is to make our practice about other people. Make our practice about other people and make it about something larger than our own small selves. And these two, other people and making it about something larger, they can be summed up in a single word, Sangha. Okay, for most of us, when we first come across the Dharma, our motivation for practice is usually our own well-being. We want to grow, we want to become wiser, more liberated and happier. And all that is fair enough. That is absolutely fair enough. And for those of us who are relatively new to the Dharma, that is a completely fair enough motivation. And if that's you, that's fine for the time being. But after a while, that motivation is not enough. So we live in this very individualistic society where people tend to want to see Dharma practice as a private, individual affair, all about me and my mental states and my meditation and my spiritual progress and my insight. And if we see practice that way, it just becomes another way of being special. It becomes another bit of our pedestal, another bigger wheels on the chariot. It becomes just another brick in the prison of our egocentricity, our separateness from others and the world around us. And the great antidote to this way of seeing our practice is other people, spiritual friendship, sangha, being part of something bigger than we are. So in practical terms, how do we do that? Well, for all of us, no matter what stage of practice there are certain things that are just built into the style of practice that we recommend in the Triratna Buddhist community, the style of practice taught by Sangharakshita, just certain things that are built in that are safeguards against this. Firstly, the first of those is the metta bhavana. So the first thing we can do is practice the metta bhavana as a central part of our meditation practice. When we do the metta bhavana, we bring concern for others into our meditation practice. So that it isn't just about me, me, me. And we let this concern for others spill over into our life and the way we live, so that our actions aren't just about serving our own specialness. We're getting down off our chariot and helping others. So, Padmavajra talked about that yesterday. The metta bhavana is the most important practice we do, particularly for us in the West, because of our tendency to see practice in this very individualistic way. And one of Sangharaksha's key teaching is the fourfold system of meditation. He talks about integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, needing to come to some extent in that order. So we need to develop a strong basis of positive emotion before we experience the spiritual death of the total perspective vortex. Or else it's going to be really shattering. And secondly, do the metta bhavana as a regular part, important part of our practice. The second is to take on board Sangharaksha's teaching about the need for spiritual friendship. So as much as we can, we spend time around other people in the Sangha, put ourselves in situations where we can spend time with them, open up to them, befriend them, nurture friendships with them. Developing friendships with people who are on the same path as we are, in an atmosphere of openness and trust, means that we can start to show ourselves to other people. We can start to open up, to be ourselves as we really are, to show ourselves warts and weaknesses and all. In other words, we can get down off our chariot and start walking with the others. And we start to take off our mask. We climb down off our pedestal and we find that other people actually like and respect us far more when we're not setting ourselves up in some way as special. When we're open and genuine and no longer trying to make ourselves special. So that's one reason that spiritual friendship is such a powerful antidote to being an ambata. And the second is that spiritual friends reflect us back to us. They reflect ourselves back to us. They mirror us. When we try and look at ourselves, we tend to see our self-image. We see, I'm up on my chariot. Hey, I'm wonderful. We tend to see our self-image. Others tend to see us much more as we are. We can't have deep, meaningful spiritual friendships and stay on our pedestal. It will be deconstructed under us by our spiritual friends. So spiritual friendship gets us down off our chariot, prepares us to meet the Buddha. So those are both aspects of practice that are central to the Tri Ratna approach. And we can all take them. We can all take them on board and put them into practice, whatever our level or experience. But if you want to take this a bit further, if you want to be a bit more radical, I'm going to suggest that we might experiment with changing the very way we see spiritual practice. That we might experiment with thinking less in terms of me becoming enlightened and more in terms of us becoming enlightened. Less in terms of my spiritual attainments and more in terms of my meditation, my insight, and more in terms of helping to bring a more enlightened community into existence. Bringing Sangha into existence, bringing enlightened community into existence. Past a certain point, spiritual progress is about transcending our limited selfhood. As Padmavajra said yesterday, it's about leaving behind our bounded, limited, constricted identity. So enlightenment is about transcending our limited selfhood and opening up to a wider sort of consciousness. A state of consciousness that transcends our limited self is going to be a state of deep connection and communication with others. This state of deep connection and communication is enlightenment. It's also what we really mean by Sangha. It's what Sangha is aiming at. It's what is trying to come into existence through the limited and imperfect Sangha that we have at the moment. So Sangha at this level is enlightenment. Sangha is the goal of the spiritual life, not just a means to an end. And yesterday, Padmavajra told us about three friends who exemplified this. Three friends who had gone beyond limited selfhood and created something much bigger than any one individual. So we heard about Aniruddha and his two friends who lived together, blending like milk and water, seeing each other with loving eyes. And we heard about how all the time they thought, why should I not put aside what I want to do and do what these friends want to do? So we saw how they'd all given up their wills to each other. But without anybody dominating anybody else, they experience a shared will based on a deep mutual harmony. So we heard how they described themselves as three in body, but one in mind. And we heard how, because they just knew what was going on with each other, their level of mutual knowledge of each other's minds made it clear that that wasn't just a figure of speech. Three in body and one in mind wasn't just a figure of speech. They were in communication with each other, even union with each other, in a mysterious way that can't be accounted for by our usual common sense model of things, our usual common sense model of the world. And Sangharakshita talks about this mysterious transcendence and coming together with others. He talks about it as third order consciousness. So he talks about group consciousness, the consciousness of the herd, people who have not yet attained individuality. And then the consciousness of the level of the individual, the autonomous individual. But then above that, third order consciousness, where we exist as individuals, but in a communion of wills with others, without sacrificing our individuality. And he uses the analogy of an orchestra. So he says, well, if you play the flute, or you play the violin, or you play whatever, if you stop playing solo and join an orchestra, you don't stop being a flute. You don't stop being a violin. You don't lose your individuality. But what you do is come together with others to create something far bigger and more complex than you could ever do on your own without sacrificing your individuality. You remain an individual, but you become part of a much higher and bigger whole. He also talks about it as the arising of the bodhicitta, the arising of the mind of enlightenment that is much more likely to occur among a group of friends who are united around something higher than themselves than it is in a single individual. Maybe for us that the state that Aniruddha and his friends are dwelling in may seem very far away. It may seem very far away. But then enlightenment is, you know, enlightenment's a long way away. What can we do for now? Well, for now, we can take on board, I think, that Sangha is not something we just passively rely on or expect to support us, but something that we all need to create among us as a central part of our practice. We all need the Sangha. None of us is going to get far without it. So in one sense, our efforts to create Sangha are more important than our personal practice, because without it, there won't be any personal practice. But, of course, we all need to do our personal practice. We're not going to be able to create Sangha unless we become more metaful, more empathic, more aware, wiser, etc., etc. So, in a sense, we need to do the same things that we always did. We need to meditate. We need to act skillfully. We need to study. We need to go on retreat. We need to spend time in solitude. We don't need to do anything different. But what I am suggesting is that we have a different way of seeing those practices. We think more in terms of doing them to make ourselves a part of Sangha. We think more in terms of doing them to create Sangha, becoming part of something bigger than ourselves, and less in terms of my spiritual attainments. And if we think in that way, we've already gone a long way to getting the ego out of the way. We've already gone a long way to getting off our chariot. We've already gone a long way towards being ready to come face to face with the Buddha and not have the experience that Ambarta did. So in the Mahayana version of Buddhism, the goal is often described as the Bodhisattva, the being who has gone so far beyond limited selfhood that their whole life is a generous expression of their solidarity and connection with others. Their motivation is to help others grow and evolve so that they too can be liberated into the same sort of joyful awareness that the Bodhisattva experiences. So that's the goal. That's the goal as presented by Mahayana Buddhism. But Sangharakshita suggests that, well, maybe we shouldn't think quite in those terms. Maybe we shouldn't think of ourselves as becoming a Bodhisattva. Maybe we should think of our Sangha, or perhaps even our Buddhist centre, as a Bodhisattva. We should see our practice as coming together to create a Bodhisattva, joining with others to create something larger than ourselves, which is going to involve getting ourselves substantially out of the way. So playing our instrument, but in an instrument, in an orchestra that plays something much more beautiful and complicated than anything we could ever play on our own. And it's his image of this. Sangharakshita holds out the image of the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. So this archetypal image of a being who holds to his heart the jewel of the enlightened mind, the jewel of compassion of the bodhicitta. So he's centered around it. He holds it at his heart. But he has a thousand arms, and each arm is offering something different to beings, offering something different to the universe. So each arm is, in a sense, an individual, but they are united. They have a united purpose. There's a unity of wills that makes the whole thing much more than the sum of the parts. And he suggests that we should think of the Sangha in those terms and think of our practice as becoming as good an arm of Avalokiteshvara as we can. And if we approach our practice in this spirit, if we approach the Buddha with this attitude and not the attitude of Ambata, if we approach reality with this attitude, we may be ready to come face to face with the Buddha. We may be ready to get a glimpse of what lies behind the Buddha's eyes. And what we will see may be awesome and awe-inspiring, but not terrifying or shattering. Sublime beauty is awesome if we're not setting ourselves above it, but it's not shattering. So what we see may be awesome and beautiful in the way that a majestic landscape is awesome and beautiful and humbling. It may be awesome and beautiful in the way that the immensity of the stars in the night sky away from the city are beautiful and majestic and awesome and humbling. It may be awesome and beautiful in the way that a sublime piece of music or a work of art can be awesome and humbling, but not terrifying or shattering. So if we've got down off our pedestal, if we've left our chariot behind, we can be humbled without being humiliated. Ambata was humiliated. We can be humbled. So when we come face to face with reality, we may find that this is a positive, joyful, liberating experience and not a shattering one. So if we approach the Buddha in this way, then we may get a glimpse into his eyes, and we may see that we are, in fact, special, but not in the way that we thought we were. So we may see that we're each a mysterious, magical miracle, part of a mysterious, magical, miraculous reality. But we will also see that everyone else is a miracle, and just as worthy of being treated with concern and special care as the centre of things as we are. And if we approach the Buddha in this way, as much as we can thinking about others, thinking about creating something bigger than ourselves, when we do get a glimpse into his eyes, when we do see into the total perspective vortex, and see the vastness and wonder of the reality that we're part of, and the tiny little arrow that says, you are here, maybe we won't be crushed and shattered by that, by seeing our place in things. Maybe instead we'll be released into a joyful sense of participation in something much larger and more beautiful and more wondrous than our limited and constricted selves. Thank you.